Talk number one by Jeffrey Hodson at the Crotona Institute School of Theosophy in Ojai, California on September the 17th, 1977, entitled The Divine Presence Throughout the Universe and Within All Mankind.
Mr. Layton and friends, thank you, Mr. Layton, for that most kind, overkind introduction on the occasion of our happy return to Crotona. Indeed, Sandra and I feel highly privileged to have been invited once again to come here and study Theosophia with those who are interested. Our very first subject may seem to some of you to be rather abstract and impersonal. However, I will endeavor to present it in such ways as my own limited mind permits me to understand. I've decided to begin by sharing with you a poem which was discovered by a padre or clergyman in the pocket of a deceased soldier during World War I. He evidently was in a shell hole, as so many of us were, waiting for the signal to advance. And he found his thoughts turning towards the deity. And though this is hardly worthy of the name of poem, it seems to me a very beautiful statement and one which will perhaps lead us together into our study. He called it, "Glad I Met You Today." And here it begins with the first verse. "Look, God, I've never spoken to you, but now I want to say, how do you do? You see, God, they told me you didn't exist, and like a fool, I believed all this. Last night, from a shell hole, I saw your sky. I figured right then that they'd told me a lie. Glad I've taken time to see things you had made. I'd have known they weren't calling a spade a spade. I wonder, God, if you'd shake my hand, for somehow I feel as though you will understand. Funny, I had to come to this hellish place before I had time to see your face. The signal, well, God, I'll have to go. I like you lots. This I want you to know. Look now, this will be a horrible fight. Who knows? I may come to your house tonight. Though I wasn't friendly to you before, I wonder, God, if you'd wait at the door. Look, I'm crying. Me, shedding tears. I wish I had known you these many years." And so, presumably, the poem and his thinking ended. The signal came. And in truth, he did arrive at the door. And so, we are in thought going to approach that self-same door. And I am drawing at the beginning upon some of the statements of fairly modern scientists. Whilst, as you doubtless know, they don't use the word deity, nevertheless, they come very close to the divine idea. Allow me to quote from certain scientists who have affirmed their belief, of course, formed upon their investigations into the existence of what they like to refer to as a directive intelligence in nature. Sir James Jeans, for example, states that for him, the universe looks less like a great machine than a great thought. He goes on, and I've copied from his writings and others here, we discover that the universe shows evidence of a designing or controlling power that has something in common with our own individual minds. The universe, he goes on, the universe can best be pictured as consisting of pure thought. The thought of what, for want of a wider word, we might describe as a mathematical thinker. Doesn't use the word God, you see. And then Sir Arthur Eddington wrote, modern physics has eliminated the notion of substance. Mind is the first and most direct thing in our experience. I regard consciousness, he writes, I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as derivative from consciousness. The old atheism is gone. Religion belongs to the realm of spirit and mind and cannot be shaken. And so, if I had time, I could have gone on quoting thus as an introduction to our study. As we do move on, and as doubtless you yourselves have found, indeed, the universe is the product of a divine thinker, and certain writers have described it as a universe which thinks. A very big advance from the old mechanistic days. But we are here, aren't we, as students of theosophy. Let us then together see what is contained within the vast body of ideas which Ammonius Saccas in the early centuries of our era at the Neoplatonic school in Alexandria, which he named in Greek with two words, Theosophia, divine wisdom. This word has been preserved, and as far as the Western world is concerned, we call it theosophy. What then does the student learn of our subject? Well, the student of this archaic doctrine discovers that the idea of a holy personal deity must be greatly expanded, if not eliminated. Indeed, the teaching is, as I understand it, that the ultimate foundation, source, and energizing, and yes, and conserving principle is far removed from the idea of a personal deity alone. The whole system of occult philosophy is based upon the most fundamental doctrine we find, which asserts unequivocally that the manifested universe is derived from and is manifested and derived from and is the expression of a single ultimate reality. And this reality, in its highest aspect, is presented to the student as a harmonized, balanced, integrated whole, without beginning, without end, an ever-present, changeless, and eternal root from which and through which all proceeds. Very abstract. May I repeat it? The occult philosophy says that the whole created system is based upon the most fundamental doctrine, which asserts unequivocally that the manifested universe, that's our world of nature all around us, the manifested universe is derived from and is the expression of a single ultimate reality. And this ultimate reality, it is affirmed in its highest aspect, is a harmonious, balanced, integrated whole, without beginning, without end, an ever-present, changeless, and eternal root from and through which all proceeds. Too abstract for us? I know it sounds so, but I must at least present it for our thinking together, impersonal though it is. But far-reaching though this theosophical presentation may seem, Theosophy affirms that the source of all that exists may also be regarded as the presiding intelligence of a single solar system. Now perhaps we're coming a little nearer to something more easily comprehended. The presiding intelligence of a single solar system, the solar logos, one might say. Here also we must enlarge our minds beyond the idea of a personal God in human form alone, and be prepared as students of the ageless wisdom. We must be prepared to go back in thought to the first cause, the sourceless source. So say the ancient philosophers and many wonderful writers, especially the mystics, being those who, fortunately for them, have had direct experience. They very wonderfully, and in other words, describe this same concept. May I quote just a paragraph from the great Flemish mystic Ruysbroeck, who wonderfully describes the indwelling deific principle, so I feel. He writes these words: beyond contemplation, mode of the mind, beyond ecstasy, mode of the enraptured feelings, beyond even intuition's power to pierce to reality, there is the supreme life, whereinto the spirit is led. And he calls it wonderfully a boundless, unwalled world, the hill of the Lord, his holy place. So beautiful. Beyond contemplation, mode of the mind, beyond ecstasy, mode of the enraptured feeling, beyond even intuition's power to pierce reality, there exists the supreme life, whereinto the spirit is led, a boundless, unwalled world, the hill of the Lord, his holy place. Wonderfully put. However, the secret doctrine or theosophia does admit, however, of the existence of a divine being, a logos, meaning, I understand, a collective creator of the universe, a demiurge or creator, in the sense implied when one speaks of an architect. We speak of an architect, don't we, as the creator of an edifice. But of course, architects never touch one stone of that edifice. But they furnish the plan and leave all the manual labor to the masons, which, by the by, in theosophy are referred to as the hierarchies of creative intelligences, the real builders of the universe, it is taught. Well, if you are interested, we'll be studying these beings, the creative hierarchies, later on in our studies together. But now then, we do have a concept of something corresponding to a divine being presiding over and pervading this our universe, our solar system. For, as I understand it, in theosophy, the solar logos may thus be regarded somewhat as a mighty being in whom all human spirits or monads, in whom all beings are synthesized to constitute one great intelligence, our Lord the Sun. So once that being was named. So the solar logos in theosophy may be regarded as the mighty being in whom all human spirits and all beings are synthesized to constitute one great intelligence, our Lord the Sun. And this inconceivably mighty being is in a somewhat similar relation to his solar system. And yes, all that it contains in the kingdoms of nature, mineral, plant, animal, human, angelic, archangelic, this great being is in a somewhat similar relationship to the inner relationship of the spirit of man with his vehicles, spiritual, intuitional, intellectual, emotional, and bodily. So that just as you have apparently a spiritual entity of which these vehicles are a manifestation and by which they are vitalized, so the solar system as a whole is, as it were, an incarnation, if I may use the term, of the one great Lord of all, the solar logos, our Lord the Sun. Perhaps, yes, perhaps I might add, our Lord the Sun, the source of life, the source of light, of consciousness, of law, and all that is beautiful. Yes, into my head comes the term, the one alone. May I carry this idea a little further? Just as this, our physical body, has its organs, which are components of the body as a whole, so the physical solar system may possibly be regarded as a physical body to the solar logos, who similarly, yes, is present, manifest, incarnate in every atom, every component of every kingdom of nature. Yes, I think that is a permissible, more or less intellectual approach. Thus viewed, the sun might also be regarded as the physical heart, while the planets may perhaps provide an analogy for the organs and limbs and the other members of the body. I know it's all one. The parts all appear as a unit, one body. So to the solar logos, we may assume the whole universe appears as one unit within which that is incarnate. So, if I'm not being too abstract, behind and within creation exists its source, its architect, to use an ancient phrase, ancient progenitor before all things. And this, for our solar system, is the solar logos, transcendent beyond and immanent within all that exists. One cannot move. I presume to say, one cannot move without touching the indwelling light and life. Even as I reach out my hand and touch and feel the air and the inner vital energy or prana with which the air is filled, I cannot do that. And you cannot, and we all cannot move ourselves and about our world without also living amidst and moving amidst, yes, and touching that which is the divine source of all. This, according to theosophy, I understand. This transcendent and imminent being, unmanifest and manifest, this infinite glory beyond and within all creation. This is the nearest in theosophy to which the mind is gradually brought to the concept of a divine and supreme presence. It is as if it were the principle of divine thought to be made manifest in an individual sense. First, as I've just been saying, as the Logos or divinity of the whole cosmos and all that it contains. Secondly, as I've just been saying, the solar deity of a single solar system. And thirdly, and so important to each one of us, thirdly, as the Logos of the soul of man, the inner ruler immortal within this body of flesh. These, yes, I mustn't make a mistake there. These are not three. The Logos of the cosmos, the Lord of the solar system, and the divine presence within each of us. Not three, but forever one, indivisible, identical, an integral part of each other, a whole. And it is, if I may digress, yes, it is to attain, however gradually at first, a realization of this presence within one, of the whole, the manifested cosmic and solar deity, the one alone, of which the divine in us is also a manifestation, the three being one. Yes, and the whole objective of yoga, which also we will be studying together later if you're interested. This is the goal and objective of the right practice of yoga, to discover oneness amidst all the diversity of which one body consists, of which the universe consists, to know in a forever unforgettable interior experience. Unity with that one alone, merged therein. Yes, that's the goal of yoga. And when that is successful, what I am presenting now, more or less in terms of mind, becomes a living, vital, and absolutely transforming and transcendental interior experience. Oh yes, theosophy has a great deal to say in guidance for each one of us in the attainment of this great goal for the individual. Realized oneness with the Supreme Deity, and through that with all that exists, one alone. But I'm straying from my subject a little. For the next thought, which Theosophy puts before us is that spiritually man and God are one and identical. Tremendous thought in a few words. Spiritually, man and God are one and identical. The macrocosm and the microcosm are one. Man is an epitome in miniature of the whole universe. The solar system, physical, superphysical, and spiritual. All this is represented within man's own nature, yours and mine, and all mankind. The sun, how wonderful this is it not? The sun, the planets, yes, the planets. Their satellites, the powers, the kingdoms, intelligences of nature, they are all potentially present within every human being. If it were not so, we could not respond to their influences, could not receive and relay their life, their power, and their consciousness. I can remember them. The words of Goethe came to my mind then. The eye could not behold the sun, he wrote, were there not contained within it a measure of the solar orb. And how could divine things enrapture us if there were not present within us that very divine source. There you have the philosopher turning into mystic. Very, very truly. May we follow that thought? It's so important. And I brought a few notes on the subject. I'll repeat, if you'll allow me, the sun, planets, intelligences, powers and kingdoms of nature are all potentially present within every human being. If it were not so, we could not respond to their influence, could not receive and relay their life and their power and their consciousness. In other words, I suppose in technical terms, there would be no station within us within which we could and from which we could respond. Yes, as I say that, the thought comes to me. Of course, there's the whole problem, isn't there, of tuning in. There's the problem. Tuning in. It's all there. The whole of the divine is there, just there, as everywhere. And it's also within, in the heart and being of each one of us. We're one. We don't know it. We don't know that that makes us a unity throughout the whole world. And so we live as we are, with the arms race, the biggest business in the world today. No. All because we can't tune in to the fact that there is but one divine, single, living, deific presence as the very soul of the soul of each one of us. This for me, this is for me where the teachings of Theosophy are so valuable and must be spread throughout the world with this wonderful message of unity. and joining with the whole science and philosophy of yoga, helping us to the discovery of that great truth, to tune in, as it were, to the divine presence. Yes, another word came to me then. Taste. Someone has said, only he who has tasted can know. Oh, in the metaphysical sense. But we'll be going into all that later on in our time together, if you're interested. But this, I placed it here because it is so important. This divine presence within us all, this is the secret of man's power. Each one of us is perpetually preserved, empowered, and sustained by virtue of the presence within each one of us of all life and all being. And this brings us to another fundamental doctrine of theosophy, which we'll be studying also later. Tremendously important. It's called the law of correspondences. In the theosophy of Hebraism, which is called the Kabbalah, this is specially studied and wonderfully presented. May I quote from Kabbalism? This interrelationship, put in other terms, of course. Here is the way it is put. In the chain of being. I remember when I first read that phrase. How wonderful. The chain of being. We're all links, presumably, do you see? In the vast, single, I'm tempted to say, chain of being. And so the Kabbalists write like this. In the chain of being, everything is magically contained in everything else. Where you stand, there stand all the worlds. And they repeat the Hermetic axiom, what is below is also above, and what is within is also without. And that everything acts upon everything else. Same idea, differently placed. And they go on like this. Man is portrayed in Kabbalism as, I'm quoting now, a symbolic transparency. Listen, friends, this may sound vague at first, tremendously important. Man is portrayed as a symbolic transparency through which the secret of the cosmos could be discerned. Kabbalists stress the interrelation of all worlds and all levels of being, affirming that everything is connected with and interpenetrates everything else. And they say, according to exact, though unfathomable law, everything possesses its infinite depths, which from every point may be contemplated. I know that's high. I know that's abstract. Listen again. Man is portrayed as a symbolic transparency through which the secret of the cosmos could be discerned. Kabbalism stresses the interrelation of all worlds and all levels of being, affirming that everything is connected with everything else and interpenetrates everything else. According to exact, though unfathomable laws, Everything possesses its infinite depths, which from every point may be contemplated. Has to be dwelt upon, doesn't it? To absorb and, oh yes, by contemplation, gradually experience. This, of course, refers to the most profound fact about ourselves, you and I, and all our fellow men. That, yes, locked up, inherent, inborn within each one of us, however embryonic, is the whole potency of the universe, of its supreme deity, and all the intelligences by means of which that is made manifest. This is all within us, within you, within each one of us, a divine and wondrous power, slowly becoming increasingly manifest as the procedures of evolution, growth, expansion, lead us to greater and greater fullness of understanding. Yes, there the thought comes to me. How important it is we should cooperate in this great procedure. Instead of blindly stumbling through life, I'm not referring to you, my friends, but humanity as a whole, as the daily news increasingly is telling us in these, I nearly said, sad days. Warfare, torture, brutality, and all the rest of it. All due to the fact of ignorance of this unity, one with another, and with that divine principle which is within each and every one of us. How could that be put? Something like this. When once the purpose for which one exists, namely evolution to ever greater heights, when once that purpose for existence is realized, yes, then the intelligent individual cooperates. And I believe, friends, and I can share this thought with you, the more fully one cooperates, more wonderfully will one's own inner understanding and usefulness in the world expand. We're here to grow, do you see? To unfold, to evolve to greater heights of beauty, usefulness, realized unity and service in love, in personal love, one to every other, our hearts beating in unison with the hearts of all. To this we must grow. And this is part, I understand, of the great message of theosophy to its students and to the world, particularly at this time. So now, as I near the closing of my talk, we come to the idea of the divine in man, the ever unknowable and incognizable deity, the causeless cause of all, has its shrine and altar on the holy and ever untrodden ground of our hearts. Invisible, true. That's why we're so hard to find it. Invisible, intangible, unmentioned, except when sometimes we hear what is appropriately called the still, small voice of our own spiritual consciousness. Oh, friends, how important to learn to listen and respond to that still, small voice within. Instead of being wholly concerned, and in a sense, rightly interested in the externals. But to save time, ah yes, time, interest for this that is taught us, and to hear that still, small voice, a voice of the God within. Those who worship before this altar may well do so in the silence and the sanctified solitude of their souls, making their spirit the sole mediator between them and universal spirit, their good actions the only priests, and their sinful intentions the only and visible victims of that divine presence. Such action to disappear as the interior reality is discovered. And as I close, I suggest one other idea. This is that man is possessed, you and I. When I say man, of course, I mean mankind. We are all of us, remember? We are all of us possessed of the power in increasing measure to know, to commune with, and ultimately to be consciously absorbed in this one eternal essence from which all is said to have come forth. Another great teaching of theosophy. We all possess, may I repeat, we all possess the power in increasing measure to know, to commune with, and ultimately to be consciously absorbed in the one eternal essence from which all is said to have come forth. And this is because it, within each one of us, we are of a spiritual nature. We are a microcosm, a little world of the macrocosm, the greater world of the cosmos of a whole, with the same inherent deific life principle in both. One and one life principle in all. This may be known, and this experience has been passed through by seers and mystics who have handed on descriptions of their intellectual and spiritual illumination. May I close with one or two specially selected utterances of this truth. Beyond contemplation, mode of the mind. Beyond ecstasy, mode of the enraptured feeling. Beyond even intuition's power to pierce to reality, there is the supreme life wherein to the spirit is led, a boundless, unwalled world, the hill of the Lord, his holy place, as I have said. And thus, the student, the aspirant, the awakening and awakened one, may come to know, or should I say, come to experience, with increasing fullness and depth and height, something of the mystery of the supreme deity and its universe, of which every one of us is a manifestation and veritably a part. And in our own Bible, as Christians, we are taught these very self-same truths. And I really close with three or four quotations. Come with me then into our Bible, where really all of this is to be found, if only one knows how to interpret. Where shall I quote from? Well, St. Paul, of course, evidently knew this. For he wrote, Christ in you, the hope of glory. He is our peace, who hath made us one, and hath broken down the middle wall of partition between us. For through him we both have access by one Spirit unto the Father. And again, know ye not that ye are the temple of God, and that the Spirit of God dwelleth in you. And again, work out your own salvation, for it is God that worketh in you. And our Lord himself, in so many places, and I quote to you one phrase which I find to be so wonderful. Our Lord is talking to the disciples after the Last Supper, probably knowing that he was going to leave them. And to them and to us all, surely, he says, that he, the Lord Christ, I am in my Father, and he in me, and I in you. Oh, what a phrase for meditation. Our Lord uttering the truth. I am in my Father, and he in me, and I in you. And last, and with this I close my last words, friends. Our Lord, as he ascended into heaven, lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. Within, of course. Thank you.
That concludes Mr. Hodson's talk.